This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast featuring weekly interviews with the most brilliant minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is always free of charge, and unlike the mainstream financial press, we're not a platform for market cheerleading. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the business telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Macro Voices Episode 17 was recorded on June 2, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Petroleum geologist Art Berman will be joining us as today's special guest. Art and I will review the analysis of oil market fundamentals that we presented back in Macro Voices Episode 3 back in February, as well as the predictions we made about supply, demand, inventory stocks, and price. We'll compare the picture as it stood then to how it looks today and get Art's take on where the story is headed from here. We also have a special second guest to introduce you to at the end of the program.
And I am Nathan Egger. Eric, we saw the S&P break through 2100 again this week, and we closed this Thursday that we are recording at 2105. Is everything as completely awesome as it seems here?
Well, I don't think it's as awesome as it seems. I definitely still think the smartest guys in the room are George Soros and Carl Icahn and Stan Druckenmiller, and really the small chorus of voices that have been saying this market is just way overdone and the Fed is taking the punch bowl away, albeit slowly. This week, Andy Scheer joined the chorus. Andy was for many years Morgan Stanley's chief economist in Asia. If there is a really smart guy who understands the feedback loops and unintended consequences of a strengthening U.S. dollar in emerging markets, Andy is the guy, and he has joined in this week in saying the global economy is not looking good and does not justify current asset prices. So what gives? How come we're seeing all this strength? I think it's probably two things. Collapsing rate hike expectations. It seems like nobody thinks the Fed is going to hike rates at next week's FOMC meeting. I'm not really sure why they think that. I think that there is room for that. One analysis that I saw this week actually said that Fed fund futures are implying as low as a 4% possibility of a rate hike. I think the number is higher than 4%, folks. I don't know that it's 50%, but I would have guessed 30%. The other one probably is the resumption of the U.S. dollar rally. Just on a technical basis, the dollar chart looks pretty strong. It seems like maybe the bottom is in. And as more international investors are looking at that, and as we continue to see difficulty in Europe, I think we're seeing a lot of capital flows into the dollar and into the U.S. stock market that's boosting asset prices. So for longs, I would say, in my opinion, now is not a bad time to be taking profits and reducing equity exposure. But it's hard to justify going short here when I can't reconcile the tape action. It doesn't really make sense to me. If we have no hike next week, as everybody's expecting, is it already cooked in and we just see the market, you know, buy the rumor, sell the news event? Or is that going to spark another rally to all-time highs? I don't know. The market is not making sense to me. And as the old saying goes, the market can stay irrational longer than I can stay solvent. And so I'm just on the sidelines right now.
We're going to save the bulk of the crude oil conversation this week for our future interview with petroleum geologist Art Berman. But our listeners should know that this interview was recorded on Wednesday to accommodate Mr. Berman's travel schedule. So Eric and Art didn't have the benefit of knowing the outcome of either the EIA inventory report, which was delayed until Thursday this week due to a holiday, or the results of the OPEC meeting, which was also on Thursday. So Eric, what do our listeners need to know in terms of the news that came out after the interview that was recorded with Art Berman on Wednesday?
Well, I think the Niger Delta Avengers striking again in Nigeria and vowing to crush Nigerian production to zero, which is a threat they made again on Thursday, is probably the biggest news to come out today. As far as the OPEC meeting, surprise, surprise, no production freeze. Oh boy, why do people think this is news? I don't know, but it was a dollar down spike on the non-news that there's no production freeze, which I think was made very clear by several ministers before the meeting. And it's something I just don't understand why the market doesn't see as clearly as I think it is. What's going on here is Saudi Arabia has no intention of agreeing to a production freeze, but they see that they can make their arch rival Iran look bad by saying, oh, look, we were willing to freeze, but oh, Iran doesn't want to play ball. And obviously, Iran's not going to agree to a freeze when they're just ramping up to get to their former production now that sanctions have been lifted. So I think this is all political theater. I don't know why anybody takes it seriously. That was a dollar down spike. Then when EIA came out, delayed until 11 o'clock today, it's usually 10:30 on Wednesdays. It was 11 o'clock on Thursday today. A 1.4 million barrel national drawdown was smaller than analyst expectations. The consensus was about a $2.5 million draw, although the Cushing, Oklahoma drawdown of 700,000 barrels was a little bit bigger than expectations. Doesn't really surprise me. Remember that the Canadian wildfires are most directly affecting that Cushing number because that's where the Alberta oil goes, is into Cushing, Oklahoma. These are very small drawdowns for this time of year. And I know that seems at odds with what we were saying a month ago when we were talking about how any build on inventory was a big deal. Now we're seeing drawdowns. Well, it just comes with the season. How do you interpret this information when it is so seasonal? The answer is something called a comparative inventory chart. If you've never seen one of those, we sent you one in your email if you are a registered user here at macrovoices.com. And Art Berman will be going into all kinds of detail to explain what comparative inventory is and how it works when we get into today's feature interview.
And we know, and those listeners who have been paying attention will know, that you're long-term bullish on precious metals, but you've also been cautioning for weeks that the party could be over in the short term for gold, as the U.S. dollar rally appears to be, for now, back on track again. And when we recorded last week's show, we were looking at gold prices around $1,220. So what's happened since then?
Well, we went and tested all the way down to $1,200, hit some round number support there at 1200, bounced back up as high again almost to 1220. As we're speaking now, just after the close on Thursday, we're looking at 1212. So the question is, we're headed down from here. Down how far? Is 1200 going to hold? There's a round number support level there. I don't think it will. The next logical target to look for after that would be the 200-day moving average, which on the futures chart is about 1168 right now. So I think that we're probably going to head down, and the Fed meeting next week will probably be where we find our direction. If there is a rate hike, I think it would be a sudden and immediate downhill move for gold. If there is no rate hike, that might mark the bottom, and we might see a reversal here. Are we at the end of a cycle where we really have begun a bull cycle and maybe this is the dip that you should be buying? Maybe. I'd like to see what happens at the FOMC meeting before I make any final decision on that.
And anything new to say about the dollar this week, Eric?
Well, you know, just that the tape action continues to be reasonably strong. We did get a little bit of a pullback this week, but still well within, you know, an ongoing uptrend. The uptrend isn't quite as vigorous as it was a couple of weeks ago. But to me, the chart still looks strong, and I think we are moving towards a higher dollar.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing us up to speed on the market. This week's featured guest is petroleum geologist Art Berman, who was also our featured guest way back in Macro Voices Episode 3, which we aired in February. Eric and Art will review the predictions they made back in February and assess the crude oil fundamentals landscape as it exists today.
And again, folks, we taped this interview on Wednesday. So Art sent us some fantastic relative inventory charts that have already been emailed to registered users at macrovoices.com.
And we're still receiving emails from people asking us to register them. And I can't emphasize enough how much I can't do this for you, as much as I'd love to. If you haven't registered yourself yet, just go to macrovoices.com, click the red subscribe for free button on the top right side of the homepage. Then click the Register for Free Macro Voices account button near the bottom of the next page that you will see. Again, it's always free, and we promise never to spam you or sell your email address to anyone. Once you're registered and logged in, you can click the Research Library function on the menu bar, then choose Documents, then choose Guest Publications. From there, you can download a PDF file containing Mr. Berman's charts. So we're going to get to Eric's interview with Art Berman. That's coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now on the program is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Art, thanks so much for coming back and joining us on the program.
It's a pleasure to be here again, Eric.
When we recorded episode 3 of Macro Voices back in February, we made a number of predictions that led me to a very bearish outlook on crude oil. At that time, prices were around $30, and we both thought that they were headed lower. So I definitely want to start by acknowledging I was dead wrong on the price call and definitely lost money as a result. And in this business, you can't get away with saying, I got the analysis right, but I lost money anyway. When you lose money, you are wrong, bottom line. But holy cow, Art, I went back and listened very carefully to episode 3, and as much as the price has done the exact opposite of what we expected it to do, almost all of the predictions that we made about supply and demand and inventory and so forth were actually spot on. So what I'd like to do in this interview is review what we said in episode 3 and compare what the situation looked like then to how it looks now. So we both agreed at that time in February that Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait were working together in this market share strategy, and we thought that their goals were probably to sabotage the source of U.S. shale oil funding, in other words, damage the junk bond market's ability to fund another shale revolution, and also to coerce at least Russia and possibly others into joining them in joint production cuts. We thought that their strategy was essentially to keep on producing as much as possible, force the price down until other countries had no choice but to join in with the OPEC countries in price cuts. But a whole lot has changed since then. Saudi Arabia allowed the price to rise dramatically in advance of that Doha production freeze meeting. Saudi Arabia fired the former oil minister, Mr. Al-Naimi, who was presumably the architect of that market share strategy. At the time that that happened, a lot of analysts thought that was bearish, that Mohammed bin Salman, the prince who fired Al-Naimi, probably was about to turn up the dial on production in order to force prices lower, as if the reason for firing him perhaps was that the prices had risen too much. But there hasn't really been any follow-through on those threats, and now this week, the United Arab Emirates is starting to talk up $60 oil. So that's not at all consistent with them still having the goals that we presumed at the time. So what does all this mean? Did Saudi Arabia change its strategy, or what's going on here?
That's a great question, and those are fantastic observations, Eric. And the simple answer is I don't know, and I don't think we ever really know. Trying to figure out the inscrutable minds behind whatever Saudi Arabia is doing, I think, is it's a fun game to play, but it's probably not one that we can win. Certainly not that I can win. But I guess my take at this point is that I really didn't see that the firing of Al-Naimi represented a change in strategy, and of course that did come after our February discussion. Why did they decide to unceremoniously get rid of him? Beats me. But at the time, I really didn't think it meant a big change in their strategy, except insofar as that one meeting in Doha, the meeting where they were supposed to agree on a production freeze that never really made much sense to anybody, but apparently Al-Naimi had put a lot of his own personal capital into that agreement, and Mohammed bin Salman just didn't want to do it. And at the time, prices were in the low 40s, going towards 45. And why do anything if prices are in the direction that you want them to go in? I mean, that's the way I read it. So I can't tell you why they fired Al-Naimi, but I think the truth and the reality is that Saudi Arabia is hurting financially, and they're not hurting as much as some people would like to think they are. They're not desperate, but they can use the revenue from higher prices, and I don't think there's any way to dispute that. At the same time, I would say that their strategy, if we're correct, in greatly restricting the flow of capital to the U.S. unconventional producers, I think that's worked. The way I read the U.S. situation, and I base this on people in the field who pretty much live in the field in places like South Texas, West Texas. I've been in both places in the last few weeks. They tell me, and I believe them, that there's no way that we're going to get back to drilling in the U.S. anytime soon in a big way. There seems to be a lot of analysts who, I might add, have absolutely no experience working in the oil and gas business that talk about, oh, well, once prices get close, you know, above 50, we're going to go right back to drilling again. I don't think that's a likely scenario. I think that the oil field service companies have gotten rid of so many people, have stacked so many rigs and other equipment, cannibalized existing rigs and equipment. I think it's going to be a long time, regardless of demand, before they're back on their feet again, ready to party on. Plus, I think that the clear evidence is, yes, there's still capital available and apparently flowing to the U.S. E&Ps, but it's not being used for drilling. It's being used to repair balance sheets. It's being used to to pay salaries and overhead costs. So I think the damage is done. And surely Saudi Arabia and everyone else who takes the time to notice understands that. So the question now is, well, what's next? You know, having perhaps accomplished some of those goals, where do we go from here? The price rise, as you said, Eric, from a fundamental standpoint, we got it, we nailed it, and as always, fundamentals. Eventually, the markets come into harmony with fundamentals, but they can take an awful lot of strange pathways to get there and even some excursions. And my read on what's happened is that Fatih Birol, the chief economist at the International Energy Agency, showed up here in Houston during CERAWeek in late February and gave a very chilling talk about future supply with all the lack of investment that's gone on in the last 2 years. The strike followed almost immediately after that, or a few weeks after that, kind of bringing everybody back to the reality of a world with no spare capacity, the result of OPEC producing like crazy for the last couple of years, among other things. And then a series of other events followed, including the wildfires in Canada, outages in Nigeria, concerns about Venezuela, none of which, by the way, affected supply. But you know, we're coming out of the stupor of the mindset that, oh my God, we're drowning in oil, and we're starting to think, well, we may have an oversupply, but it's precarious. And the other thing that's important to understand is, there just hasn't been any real global economic bad news. A lot of what was pushing prices down below $30 was all this terrible depression about what's happening in China and their currency devaluation and their inability to control their stock market. China's retrenched. They've gone back to controlling their currency, and we haven't heard any bad news. And even this latest round of potential Greek problems that brought the market down last summer, in part, they fixed that real quickly. So, there just seems to be, you know, a harmony of a lack of bad economic news, more attention to outages, even though we've kind of had them before, and just this overwhelming wish that we're just really sick of low oil prices. The market wants to find every reason it can to push them higher, and you put all those together, plus interest rates. Let's not forget interest rates. Interest rates have pretty much been going down ever since prices started going up, and that's that's another consistent relationship. And you mix it all up, and you got the price rally that we're looking at now.
And, of course, the U.S. dollar rally pausing certainly did not help with respect to a bearish outlook on oil prices. But one thing we were very clear about is we both thought our bearish view on oil prices back in February was short term. And we both agreed that in the second half of 2016, the market would rebalance itself. So the question becomes, how close are we to that happening? Because even though I think we did get a lot of those fundamental factors spot on, the fact is it's not February anymore, it's June. And second half starts next month. So we were both extremely skeptical back in February of the 2.24 million barrel oversupply estimate that IEA had just released when we did that interview. We both thought it was going to be really lower than that. And of course, it was subsequently revised way lower. But we also agreed that U.S. production needed to decline much more dramatically than it had at the time before the market would balance. So what's the update, Art, on U.S. production? Where is it now and where is it headed?
U.S. production declined 100,000 barrels a day, roughly, in April compared to March. Now, the EIA, the U.S. Department of Energy, they went back and completely revised all of their numbers going back as far as a year, and essentially increased consumption, which is what they use as a proxy for demand. And the result of that is that kind of as we suspected, that those near months in the early part of 2016, the oversupply, at least from EIA's perspective, was significantly less than they had previously said. So I think in a way we were spot on in those observations as well. You know, how much stock do you want to put in these kind of revisions? I don't know. I think it's normal to be skeptical about them. At the same time, where else are you going to go for data? I mean, you got EIA and you've got IEA. IEA comes out with quarterly data, and so when we have the full picture for the second quarter, great. But we don't, and so EIA is what we have to work with. So I think the story is that the oversupply was, to some extent, I won't say it was exaggerated, it was just overestimated a little bit, and we had so much momentum on the downside coming into the new year that kind of colored the sorts of wording that were used in IEA, EIA reports, and certainly the press coverage of it. And now the mood has shifted. It's, again, mostly momentum, which is a nice way of saying sentiment. But there are some reasons behind it. And, you know, I've stated a few of those, which have to do mostly with world events. But, you know, let's talk about inventories, because that really is the story that I think is ultimately what is going to tell the, you know, where we go with price. And so,
well, and that just blows my mind, Art, that inventories, when we spoke before, inventory was at 85%, and you were very emphatic in saying history teaches us when Cushing, Oklahoma inventory goes over 80%, prices get crushed, and there's a lot of data to back that assertion up. That was 85%. We went all the way to 96.42% 2 weeks ago, and prices rose 90% at the same time. I mean, how could that be possible, number one? And number two, I think an even stronger indication besides outright price is the contango, the difference between the first and second month. And at that time, because everybody was worried about storage, we were seeing contracts closing at as much as a $2 spread, $2 discount in the expiring contract to the next contract. But now that we're above 95% of operating capacity at Cushing, that first to second month spread is only 39 cents, which just doesn't make any sense to me. Can you make any sense of this?
Well, no, I really can't, because you're 100% right that all right, comparative inventory, that's what I look at. And in some way, I think that a lot of professional traders look at some version of that, you know, comparing at least current inventory with a year ago. And there's no doubt that you can look at just the absolute inventories, that, you know, the spread between earlier in the year or the end of last year and today, that difference is narrowing. And when I say comparative inventories, I'm comparing this year, the current storage, with a moving average of the last 5 years. And so it is declining, and that's a positive thing. And so going back to history, when we look again at the price rally in April, May, June of 2015, we had grotesque overhang of storage, but prices did go up to $60, and there was a very nice and pronounced falling comparative inventory. Now, it didn't last, partly because people went back to drilling, but partly because I think the reality of how much we have in storage came home to kind of haunt people, and they said, oh my God, what are we getting so excited about? And I suspect that something similar to that is where we're heading today, that, you know, the market wants to push the price up. We are seeing comparative inventories falling, both U.S. and Gulf Coast. Gulf Coast is by far the largest single storage area. The problem is that Cushing was falling for a while, and it's been rising for the last several weeks. So there's some mixed signals there. But the bottom line, just to cut through it, is, all right, comparative inventory's falling. That's a good thing. We usually see a price response to that, and we do. But will we wake up, as we did in July of 2015, and say, well, that is a great thing, but we still got so much storage, we're at such a high percentage of capacity, how's that going to work? And prices slid. I don't anticipate that we're going to go back down that much. But people who think that prices just move in one direction really need a lesson in history, because they never do. As I've written, and I'll say it again, I think that we're going to see a series of price cycles. We're in one now. These cycles for the last couple of years have lasted on average about 150 days, which means that, you know, we're on the outside of this cycle, and I suspect that something is going to bring it back down. We haven't been able to, you know, we've seen resistance at $50. That seems to be kind of a top for this one, and I suspect it's going to go down. It's not going to go down as low as it had before, probably, barring some kind of, you know, terrible economic world news or something like that. But it's going to go down before it goes back up again. And then this storage thing, there's no way, in my way of looking at the world, that people that talk about getting to $70 or $80, not until we work off 100, 150 million barrels of U.S. storage, and we're not going to do that in anything less than something like a year. It's just not going to happen. Short of, you know, if Venezuela shuts down all of its production, that'll be a different story. But in a relatively normal functioning world, which means you have periodic outages and all of that and periodic conflicts, it's going to take a long time. It's going to take 9, 12, I don't know, 16 months to work through it, assuming everything keeps moving in one direction.
Now, before we move away from comparative inventory, I just want to point out, you sent us a PDF file, which we've already emailed to all of our registered users at macrovoices.com. Any listeners who are not registered can go and register and then find that PDF in our research library download area. You did include a comparative inventory chart, actually a couple of them, in that handout. Could you just define comparative inventory, comparison of what to what, and then what exactly is the chart telling us?
Okay, so So the way this works is I take this week's storage number, whatever it is, and I compare it to a four-week moving average of last year, 2015, and the four previous years. So you get a number that averages the 4 weeks prior to today in all of those past 5 years. And what that does and why it's so powerful is because it normalizes out the kind of seasonal issues of more use, less use, refinery maintenance, you know, all kinds of things like that. Because everything I'm comparing it to is happening at the exact same time of the year when those seasonal or maintenance kinds of events ordinarily happen. So it is truly a relative thing. It's happening right now. So if comparative inventories are falling, that means that's irrespective of weather and irrespective of maintenance and other kinds of issues. So it's saying that we are seeing a real drop. It's not just an absolute a number. It's compared to normal usage. And why that's important, obviously it's an important benchmark, but what I didn't include in the package, because it's a little bit confusing to look at, is when you plot that comparative inventory versus price, and it's hard to look at because there's no time scale on it, that gives you a yield curve. And that yield curve is absolutely the best predictor of price trends that I know of. And when we see that yield curve turn around and start paralleling or following a trajectory that we know from the past, then we can tell where the mid-cycle price is. And the mid-cycle price is the price that the market, whatever the market is, thinks is necessary to maintain supply. That doesn't mean it's going to be tomorrow's price, but that's the direction that we're going. So that's what comparative inventory is about. It's not something that I expect everybody to immediately latch on to and say, oh, yeah, I get it. You know, I'm going to start doing that, because it's a little bit abstract. But it is by far the most, if you had to choose one thing, it is the most significant, meaningful, and insightful way to look at where prices are going and even getting a little bit specific about where they're headed. So that's why I think it's very, very important.
Now, you mentioned that $50 magic number that seems to be a psychological barrier. We have traded, and you mentioned actually in the February interview, that $50 to $50 was, even for the very best operators, the people that had the very best plays, the best land leases, $50 to $55 was their break even. They're not even making any money at that. We've traded above $50 for all of about 20 minutes, quite frankly, so far. A couple of little spikes to just above 50. They didn't last long. We're just right around 49 as we're speaking on this Wednesday that we're recording this interview. So how is it possible that I'm already seeing articles in the paper about how U.S. drillers are gearing up for more drilling because they've got $50 oil prices? Is this rhetoric that they're spewing, trying to get the sources of funding to believe that they could be profitable, or is it true that they could actually be profitable? I mean, should we expect the rig count to tick up from here as we hit $50 and the shale drillers go back to work?
Well, those are critical questions, Eric. And again, the answer is I don't know, but I don't think so. The rig count over the last couple of weeks has effectively, it's flattened out. I mean, you know, we're losing a couple of rigs a week as opposed to 20 or 15 or 25 rigs a week not very long ago. And there's a reason for that. I mean, it's a diminishing returns thing. You reach a point where, you know, you just can't, you don't have any more rigs to get rid of. I mean, we're down to, you know, to just sort of basic maintenance at this point. So, and as far as, you know, the break-even price, I'm sure that all the listeners are just completely bewildered by the range of break-even prices that they read about and they hear. And I mean, there was a Bloomberg report, and they put it on television at one point about all the counties in Texas that can actually make money below $40 oil, and there's even a few, they said, that can make money in the 20s, and that's just pure crap. I mean, that is just so fundamentally distorted and untrue that it's painful to me, because I mean, this is the business I'm in, and I've got a pretty good sense of what the floor is, and I promise you, nobody's making money or breaking even at the prices that Bloomberg report was talking about. And so the question is, well, how did they get there? And they get there in a real simple way. They exclude costs. They exclude taxes and royalties and overhead and interest expense. You exclude everything except for drilling and completion. And, well, yeah, okay, that'll get you down to a pretty low number, but that's not real. I mean, that's like me telling my bank that my only monthly cost is my mortgage. Well, they're not going to believe that. They're going to say, yeah, what about loans, and what about do you eat? do you drive a car? I mean, those are, without those, I don't live. And it's the same for these companies. They, to use some number and to not even discount it. I mean, that's another thing they do. So there's a million things. I could talk for an hour or two just about the flaws in the way that many analysts evaluate the profitability of these companies. Why did they do it? Well, they're selling stuff, aren't they? I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's the business they're in. They're pushing stock. They're pushing investment banking transactions, and they need to talk it up, and that's what they do. But it's wrong. It's not even close to true. And I'm not the only one that thinks that. And this is the business I'm in. I mean, I'm not an analyst. I drill wells. I make maps. I explain dry holes. I look at deals. That's the world I live in. And I promise you that there are no companies, little bitty companies like the one I'm sitting in right now, that has very little overhead and no debt. we can't make money at the prices that some of those analysts say others are. So, $50 is an absolute floor for companies that just happen to be in the very sweetest parts of the very best plays. And like you said, Eric, they're not making money. That's break even. Okay? And they're not investing. They're not growing at those prices. So, go back to drilling at $50? I don't think so.
I'd love to spend that hour and a half talking this up in more detail, but we need to move on. So I want to go to the really big thing that we both predicted. I think actually we both predicted it would happen someday. I think you even said you thought it was likely to happen in 2016, which is that Saudi Arabia and OPEC would eventually cut production in order to support higher prices. And we predicted that several things had to happen before that. One, we thought that capital providers needed to pull back meaningfully so that shale didn't have the source of funding it had. You said already that the signs that you're seeing is that has happened. We also said that U.S. production had to drop significantly. And the number that you cited was, at the time, we were seeing maybe drops of 50,000 barrels per day in a given month from the previous month. You thought that number needed to go to 150. It's gone to about 100. So maybe we're halfway there. I had suggested that I didn't think that OPEC would cut until Russia joined the party and agreed to cut with them. Just this week, Russia pulled away from their previous willingness to agree to a freeze. Never mind cuts, just a freeze. They're no longer willing to do that. So we're not there yet on that one. What's your take now? Do you still see these things as prerequisites to OPEC cutting? And do you still think an OPEC cut is likely, which would imply that those things would get resolved over the course of 2016?
Well, let's just back up a second and talk about U.S. production, because you did ask me that, and I did say that, you know, it had fallen 100,000 barrels in the last month. And the EIA forecast on that, I think, is worth looking at. And I don't believe anybody's forecasts out, you know, more than 6 or 12 months, but I think that the EIA is probably pretty close to right on that, and they're saying that by the end of the summer, by September, U.S. production will have fallen 1.5 million barrels per day, roughly, since the peak in April 2015. So we'll be down close to 8 million barrels a day from a high of about 9.7 million barrels a day. At the same time, it's worth looking at what EIA thinks West Texas Intermediate prices are going to be, and they're already wrong. But interestingly, by December 7th of 2017, the end of their forecast, they see WTI at $59. Again, I wouldn't take that to the bank or anything, but. I do have a certain amount of respect for the sophistication of the modeling and the work that goes on there, just as a rough kind of a benchmark number. So EIA is not, they're not seeing prices going back to, you know, to $70 or $80. Is it enough? The answer to that is it depends. It depends on what's happening in the rest of the world. And the mood and the sense right now is that the rest of the world is precarious, and I think it's relevant. We were talking about the damage done to U.S. producers and the financial providers and enablers. Well, I think a lot of the rest of what's going on in the world, the outages in Nigeria, the outages in Venezuela, these are directly related to the governments of those countries having no money from lack of oil revenue. And so we reach a point where the pain gets so bad that we actually have countries on the verge of failure. And that's where we are. And so the time for some relief from price before the world order implodes on itself, I think is at hand. And is there, you know, are there some silent hands working behind the scenes to try to restore, you know, some semblance of future order? I don't know. I don't subscribe to those kinds of theories, but we are in that kind of scenario right now, and it's dire. I mean, we really need to take this seriously. It's not a thing we can do about it, but the specter, I mean, Venezuela produces more than 2 million barrels a day. And that country is on the verge of collapse. And, you know, you take 2 million barrels of oil off the world market, and I promise you that prices are going to go up a lot. So are we there based on U.S. production? No. We're sure heading in the right direction. And is 1.5 million barrels a day by the end of the summer enough? It's probably enough, given everything else that's going on in the world. And that's changed a lot too, Eric, since we talked a couple of months ago.
Yeah, one of the things that I think a prediction you made in February that was very prescient, you said everybody's talking about Iran, but the true wild card, was your word, is Libya, not Iran. Now, at the time, nobody was talking about Libya, and we were discussing it in the context of, you know, you said if Libya were somehow able to solve their unrest problems, they could increase their production, and that would be very bearish for prices. Of course, the opposite has happened. It's gone the other way, and their unrest has gotten much worse, which I think you had actually said in that interview. You didn't think it was likely they could solve their unrest problems. Meanwhile, we've got the situation you described in Venezuela, literally on the verge of societal collapse. And for our listeners who may not be aware, what's going on there is Venezuela's most important thing it has to do is keep producing and selling oil. But they have mismanaged their country so badly that the foreign contractors that are essential to producing oil were not getting paid and basically gave up and went home. And they're not able to produce as much oil because the whole country is falling into disarray. Nigerian militants attacking pipelines, creating major shortages, and of course the Canadian wildfires. The estimates I've seen from analysts are as high as 3.75 million barrels taken offline as a result of these various geopolitical developments. And of course, we were only talking about a 1 to 1.5 million barrel oversupply. If you subtract 3.75 from 1.5, you get a negative number. And so it looks like, you know, the surplus, the oversupply, is now a deficit. So I think the key thing is, are these things temporary or are they going to last? And particularly, can these geopolitical events last long enough to get us to that point later in 2016 when you thought that the market was going to rebalance itself anyway because of U.S. production declines? So what's your take on these things, particularly Canada, because that's the one that most directly affects Cushing inventory, which we both agree is very critical.
Well, as I understand it, despite all the, you know, the fanfare, and it was a gripping thing to watch those fires, that Canadian supply to the U.S. did not change. And, I mean, you may have more information on that than I do, but that there was enough oil in storage available that, you know, that was a temporary thing, albeit a dramatic one. So I've seen the same reports that talk about 3+ million barrels a day offline, and frankly, I just don't believe it. I think that's what could potentially happen, or what, you know, may have, you know, could have potentially happened. But I just don't see numbers like that. You know, you want to add 2.3 million a day from Venezuela into that, or half of that, yeah, sure, you can get there. But that hasn't happened yet, and I think we have to keep that in mind, that, you know, the sky is falling. People get hysterical about things like that. And let's talk about, you know, what has happened versus what may happen. So, back to February, you know, Iran, yep, they're going to increase production. And we've seen it, and it's steady, and it's within predicted ranges. And for Iran to be at a half a million or even 600 or 700,000 barrels a day above December sometime in 2016, I think is probably realistic. Iraq was the big, you know, the big sleeper that nobody was paying attention to. Iraq was the country second only to the United States that had increased its production the most since early 2014. It seems like Iraq's economic and political problems have probably reached a point where that production is not going to grow anymore, and it may actually fall. Libya, if I had to say, I mean, Libya is probably incrementally closer to a solution than they were when we talked in February. At least they have a unity government. It's not functioning very well, but there is a government, and that's a step in the right direction. So I don't want to get anybody's hopes up about Libya, but let's not forget, Libya solves its civil problems, and there's a million barrels a day that is right back online. So I still see there are plenty of sources of oversupply remaining in the world. And let's not forget either that. Even these very desperate countries and companies, they still have to produce for cash flow, and they're going to take advantage of higher prices. These higher prices of nearly $50 from $30, $20 a barrel, I mean, that is a huge increase. It doesn't bring them back to profitability. And I guess the other thing that's important to bear in mind, and I didn't send the chart, but it's on my website. I've got a chart that compares, you know, OPEC fiscal break-even numbers from the IMF with the oil sands plays in Canada and the key U.S. Shale plays. And the truth about that situation is that for as expensive as unconventional oil, deep water, oil sands, tight oil is, that so is everybody else's oil, including OPEC. And this idea that OPEC has been, and Saudi particularly, has been promoting, you know, that we're the low-cost producers and you guys are the high-cost producers, well, not when you consider overhead. Companies have overheads and countries have overheads. And you look at those numbers and everybody, I mean everybody, has to have at least $50 oil to break even, including OPEC. And that's the world we live in, and you know, that's something that most people don't want to pay attention to. The age of cheap oil is over. That's momentum moving us in the other direction, unfortunately.
Speaking of OPEC, I'd like to go back to Saudi Arabia, and particularly something that the firing of Mr. Al-Naimi really spoke to me is the ascendance to power of Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the 30-year-old prince, who apparently is kind of the head honcho in charge now in Saudi Arabia. So I immediately wanted to learn more about this guy and find out what his vision of the future was. And very conveniently, he had just published a document called Vision 2030, which I expected to articulate Saudi Arabia's energy future strategy. This guy is talking about getting Saudi Arabia out of the oil business and into the tourism business. I just don't know what to... I was speechless to read that. Is this guy lost in space? Is this intentional misinformation? Is he serious about what he's saying, that Saudi Arabia should move away from dependency on oil exports, which really is the key natural resource that the country has?
Well, you're not alone in that reaction, Eric. There are an awful lot of Saudi Arabia watchers who know a lot more than I will ever know about the royal family and the internal workings of that country, who think that his vision 2030 is reckless, is irrational, that it's meant to produce an effect which is by gosh, we're going to change in a big way, and that's something that is needed for internal consumption in Saudi Arabia, apparently. But let's talk about reality. So Saudi Arabia, I don't think it's going to be a big tourist. I mean, it's not on my list of places to visit with my family. The Saudi munitions piece, I guess, is perhaps the most doable part. But you know, on a more philosophical level, it seems to me that what I was just talking about, that oh my gosh, if everybody in the world's break even price is $70 or $80 on average, you know, is there an end to the age of petroleum just because the world can't afford it coming in the near future, and put in the kind of price spikes that are inevitable as a result now of 2+ years of underinvestment? And that perhaps Mohammed bin Salman is thinking along those lines. I honestly can't decode the message there for myself, much less for other people. But he is let's give him credit. He's probably a very smart guy, but let's also remember that a lot of this is for internal consumption and dramatic effect.
I have several more questions on my outline here, Art, but unfortunately we're starting to run out of time. I do want to just quickly go over the charts that you sent us. Give our listeners a quick sense of what's in that PDF so that they know what they're looking at when they open it up.
Well, there's three charts that show comparative inventory versus price along a timeline. And they're going to see that there's Cushing, which I think is absolutely central to understanding pricing, and what's interesting about Cushing is that comparative inventory fell through mid-April and then started rising again. So that's a counter-current kind of movement. The total U.S., that's commercial crude oil, I show the same kind of data there. And what we see there is that beginning in mid-March, those comparative inventories started falling, which is consistent with the price rise. And then I think the final chart that I had there was a combined Cushing plus Gulf Coast, and that accounts for something like 70% of U.S. storage. And there I'm showing that the comparative inventories are generally falling, but I'm also showing a front-to-back future spread. So, you know, that's typically going to be like a June-December futures contract spread, and it rolls a little bit forward in the last month or so of that chart. But that gives, you know, some idea of the incentive for, you know, for lower price or higher price. And so typically the higher spreads reflect lower prices and vice versa. So those are the charts. And then, of course, the other one that's always, people always forget to think about, or some people do, is going to be the strength of the dollar versus the futures price. And that's the NYMEX WTI. And I use a Wall Street Journal dollar index, but you can use a lot of them. And so people scramble for explanations for why oil prices are falling and rising, and they're all valid. But I always remind myself to look at this, because when the strength of the dollar is high, prices tend to go down, and vice versa. And, you know, that's a whole other discussion as to why that happens. But empirically, that's generally the way it works. So those are the charts.
Fantastic. As we close, I think our listeners already know your blog at artberman.com is free and one of my favorite resources on the internet. Your for-profit business is Labyrinth Consulting. Tell us a little bit about what you do and what services you offer.
Labyrinth is basically me and a couple of engineering colleagues. We advise investment companies, hedge funds, money managers on their portfolios. We do reserve forecasts. We do economics. And we also do basic geology. So that's what we do. We have a very interesting and diverse clientele.
Well, Art, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Nathan Egger and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Every time I hear Art speak, Eric, I enjoy it. There is no unnecessary emotion, no BS, not even a lot of opinion unless you're begging him for it. It's just insightful analysis. But I'm curious, after this update from Art, what are your conclusions about where we are in this whole crude oil story?
Well, the biggest thing that I see is really this question of what is Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait's agenda, really, and has it changed? I was absolutely convinced that there was no way that Saudi Arabia went on this market share strategy on an indefinite basis, just thinking it was a smart idea to do for the long term. Obviously, they're going to suffer lower total revenue from their oil sales as a result of allowing the price to drop. So I've made the assumption that they were intentionally allowing the price to drop in order to do damage to their competitors, and I believed to coerce Russia and others into playing ball with them. I think perhaps what's happened is Russia did capitulate. They were talking about a freeze, but probably could have been led down a negotiation path towards a joint cut. And I think that Saudi Arabia is not willing to talk about a freeze or a cut or anything when Iran is growing production. The idea politically in Saudi Arabia of the Saudis reducing production in order to allow Iran to increase it is just on every level, socially, culturally, religiously, it is anathema to everything that they stand for. And I cannot figure out this Mohammed bin Salman guy who is preaching about how Saudi Arabia should get out of the oil business and into the tourist business. That just doesn't make any sense. So I really think the key is in understanding what their intentions are, and at what point are they going to be willing to consider some kind of joint cut. That's not happening yet, and I do think that we are at the top of a cycle. technicians I'm reading are saying 5190 is a major retracement level that might mark a top in this cycle. I'd consider shorting it from there. In the meantime, I'm just in the crude oil term structure steepener trade that we've talked about in previous episodes and waiting to see what happens.
Well, as the Macro Voices project gains momentum, we're excited to be growing our team here. It's been necessary, but we've come across some great people to help us out with the content of this program. So we're pleased to announce that Aaron Chan is joining our production team, and we're going to spend the last few minutes of today's show introducing Aaron to our audience. So Eric, give us the backstory on how Aaron will fit into the team before we bring him in to introduce himself.
Well, as I've described in prior episodes, the whole vision for the Macro Voices project is to create a global community of sophisticated private investors, family offices, and other smart people, and to encourage them to collaborate and share investing ideas online. We've actually had several people reach out to us and expressed interest in helping the cause, but Aaron Chan has probably been our most vocal proponent. Ever since episode one, Aaron has been talking us up on Twitter, sending us interesting articles for our research roundup, and so forth. And believe me, folks, we need the help. This project has turned out to be way more work than Nathan and I first imagined. Registered users probably noticed that this week's research roundup email was kind of light on content, and that's just because we're swamped and we don't have time to do as good of a job as we had first envisioned with the research roundup. So Aaron has agreed to join our team as the captain of what we're calling the Macro Voices Research Team. The first responsibility of the research team under Aaron's leadership will be to curate and expand our research roundup emails, which have been extremely well received so far. Over time, we envision the research team also helping us to identify and recruit future interview guests for the program and to help us refine the format in order to promote the development of that global community of sophisticated investors that I described a moment ago.
So we're going to go ahead and introduce Aaron to our listeners. Aaron, welcome aboard. Please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your personal and professional background, and how you discovered Macro Voices.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to join the team. Well, I'm originally from Toronto, and I'm currently based in New York. Academically, I studied finance on a Division I tennis scholarship at Fairfield University, and then received my master's in sustainability management with an emphasis on energy markets from Columbia University. In terms of my professional experience, I was a fixed income derivative summer analyst at Morgan Stanley, and then afterwards an energy investment banking analyst at JP Morgan. Following my time in investment banking, I decided to level up my data analysis skills and recently graduated from a full-time data science program at Galvanize in San Francisco. Although not finance-related, this program culminated with a capstone project I worked on where I designed a system that scraped data from over 100,000 Kickstarter crowdfunding campaigns and applied a random forest classification algorithm to predict fundraising success with around 80% accuracy. With all that being said, I'm now looking to apply my finance and data science skills towards asset management and macro research. As for how I discovered Macro Voices, I would say that there are really two main drivers. Back in January and February, when I was interviewing with tech companies, as you know, markets were tanking and China was seemingly falling off the precipice. So I found myself reading voraciously about what was happening while repositioning my own portfolio, as in getting off of the QE escalator. I was reading and listening to all the mainstream financial outlets, but was really left desperately wanting for more nuanced and sophisticated analysis. So secondly, I love the podcast medium. I even started my own project, the Laissez-Faire Podcast, with one of my best friends from college, Ricardo Espaillat, where we talk about politics, economics, and finance from the perspectives of free markets and individual liberty. So in the process of working on my own project, I stumbled upon Macro Voices, and I was basically hooked from day one, because it introduced me to content that I hadn't seen or heard anywhere else, and it also introduced me to a community of like-minded, inquisitive people.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for volunteering to help us with this project. We are excited to have you aboard. Why don't we start by telling our listeners, first of all, where they can find your podcast in case they're interested in that, but also what is hashtag MVRR all about and how can our listeners use it?
Yeah, for sure. You can find my podcast on iTunes. It's the Laissez-Faire Podcast, and we're also on SoundCloud. As far as the MVR hashtag on Twitter, Eric, as you had mentioned earlier, our vision is to create a global community of sophisticated investors to collaborate and share investing ideas online. As such, the weekly Research Roundup newsletter is really one of the main vectors through which we can build and share interesting research with our community. So to that end, we are introducing the MVRR hashtag as a way for our Twitter-savvy listeners to tag interesting research or articles for inclusion in the next Research Roundup. Of course, our non-Twitter listeners also have the option of submitting content to our Research Roundup at macrovoices.com email as well.
So basically, any listener who's got something that they think is worthy of our other listeners' attention that should go into our Research Roundup email, the two options are to email us at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, or if you're on Twitter, just retweet with the #MVRR hashtag, and that will get Aaron's attention, and he'll be able to evaluate whether it fits into the next Research Roundup email.
That's right.
So again, Aaron, I cannot thank you enough for helping us out in this capacity. I hope to find ways to make this experience as rewarding for you as I'm sure your contribution will be for our listeners. But we are putting you basically in charge as the captain of a ship that doesn't yet have a crew. So please tell us what kind of help you're looking for as you build the Macro Voices research team.
Yeah, for sure. So initially, for the purposes of sourcing and curating content for the Research Roundup, we're looking for a team of volunteers who have experience reading financial literature, be it out of personal interest or for their own investing. The process itself is still being developed, but I envision one that is collaborative. And I know we have listeners from all around the world, so all time zones are welcome. I'd also encourage our Twitter-savvy listeners to volunteer. Our goal is to build out the community, and Twitter is one of the venues where we can really do that while engaging in the marketplace of ideas. And lastly, generally speaking, we want volunteers who are eager to learn and want to be part of building something that, for me, and I'm sure for tons of our listeners, contributes greatly to our financial education. Again, this is not an exhaustive list, and nor should it be construed as a set of job requirements. Participation is purely on a volunteering basis, and as this project continues to grow, there may be opportunities for greater involvement, be it in guest recruiting or content development. In that vein, we also encourage listeners who have skills outside of finance and social media. But Eric, more than anything, I'm most looking forward to getting to know and learning from other engaged listeners.
And if our listeners want to volunteer some of their own time to help the cause, how can they contact you, Aaron?
Yeah, listeners can email me directly at aaron@macrovoices.com and on Twitter at @AaronChan_.
So that's AARON@macrovoices.com. Besides outright volunteering to help us here at Macro Voices, the best way you can support Macro Voices is by subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on iTunes. This helps us move up in the rankings and gain more visibility. What we're essentially trying to do is get the word out. So telling your friends, family, coworkers, sharing on social media, this really helps us grow. Speaking of social media, you can follow us on Twitter @MacroVoices, and Eric has a personal handle, which is @EricSTownsend. That's E-R-I-K-S Townsend. And remember, folks, #MVRR is how you get our attention on Twitter for research that you would like to see included in our Research Roundup. Aside from Twitter, you can continue the discussion of topics covered on the show by joining us in our forums at macrovoices.com/forums. We really hope you'll be back again next week as Dr. Ben Hunt will be joining us. He is the Chief Risk Officer at Salient Partners and the author of the popular newsletter Epsilon Theory. For Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, this is Nathan Egger wishing you all a great weekend. We'll see you next time.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.